Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, we are going to talk about closing the diagnosis delay in spondyloarthritis. Our guest is Dr. Norma Bilne. She is founder and chair of the board of Augurex Life Sciences Corp., a University of British Columbia spin-out biotechnology company that over the last two decades has focused on arthritis biomarker research. Dr. Bilne's passion for improving arthritis patient outcomes led her to pursue her doctoral research in strategies to reduce patient diagnostic delay in the rheumatology referral pathway. As a leading figure in the biotechnology sector, Dr. Bilne was recognized as the Western Regional winner and national finalist for the 2023 RBC Canadian Women Entrepreneur Innovation Award, 2018 British Columbia Business Most Influential Women STEM Stars, and a 2017 Canada's Most Powerful Women Top 100 Award winner, and a 2017 nominee to the Order of Canada. She holds a Bachelor of Science in Physiology from McGill, a Master's in Business Administration, a PhD in Population and Public Health from UBC, and an NACD Directorship Certification from the U.S. National Association of Corporate Directors. Norma, welcome to SpondyCast. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me, Jill.
Thank you. I'm excited because this is a favorite topic of ours here on the diagnosis delay. So can you just tell me as we get started, what drew you into spondyloarthritis?
Yeah, so I started Augurex with my co-founder, Anthony Murata, about 17 years ago. And it was primarily in rheumatoid arthritis. But with it being an inflammatory arthritis, our research led us to realizing that the biomarkers we were working on actually had implications in spondyloarthritis. So we started to do research in that area and started to understand just what a high unmet need there was. So part of it was kind of working in the area of inflammatory arthritis and really stumbling across what an incredible unmet need there was and how long people were waiting for a diagnosis. And I think the second piece was when I started to work on my PhD and was looking at different tools that were available that are just patient self-administered tools, so not including blood tests or biomarkers, I started to realize that in inflammatory arthritis, axial spondyloarthritis had some of the largest literature in terms of tools that were being tested to help identify people earlier on in the disease course. So it was really, kind of stopped me in my tracks to say, wow, people are really waiting 7 to 10 years. And it was really stumbling across that reality that made it now a real almost a fixation, if you will, on finding out how do we combine different modalities, including questionnaires, including biomarkers, existing ones and our novel ones, to really get upstream in this disease.
So why do you think it's still happening in 2025?
Yeah, so, you know, it's, I think, a combination of a few things. So I think access is one of the things as far as tools. So, and I think it's probably because we're not that digitally integrated yet in terms of having a patient questionnaire kind of combine with the data around what's your CRP, are you HLA-B27 positive? That doesn't really exist yet as far as data access standpoint. So that's in the way. Referral pathways are actually still not really optimized if you think about it. You know, I learned not long ago that GPs in their training during their residency to become a general practitioner only get about 11 hours of rheumatology training. And with axial spondyloarthritis being one of those conditions in rheumatology, they may not even have really come across it very much during their training. Yeah. So part of it is that awareness and therefore access, because if the GP doesn't know to refer, you're not going to access the rheumatologist who will be able to make the diagnosis, right? Yeah. So
do you think some of the literature is outdated in medical school? I know my daughter is in nursing school and she snapped me a slide of that they had about AS and it showed, 1% of diagnoses are women.
Really?
This year.
Wow. Right? No. So. Wow. That's profound. I had not heard that's crazy. Yeah.
But I heard a lot of, we definitely have a problem that we're trying to solve.
Definitely.
So I want to talk a little bit, I want to come back to this topic of, questionnaires and pathways, but you've developed your own out of your work. Correct.
Yeah. So the work I did in my PhD was combining questionnaires and putting them digitally. So what I took was two already validated questionnaires that exist. And so what the novelty of what I did was bringing them together, seeing how they inform inflammatory arthritis and getting them digital to see, and getting patient feedback and rheumatologist feedback to see, can they be adopted? How can they be improved? And actually, do they perform well? And we found that with a combination of the markers together, the tools together, these patient self-administered questionnaires. And so the study that I did and the name of the questionnaire that I developed that combined these is called the patient said questionnaire, to hear the patient voice. So what does the patient say, or the patient said, which is self-administered inflammatory arthritis detection tool. So it's SAID. And it's really because, and on your previous question, when you were asking, why has it taken so long? The big part of it historically also is that it often presents as back pain. So there's a part that is also, again, awareness that, patients think that that back pain is innocuous and it may not be a thing, even when it goes on for a long time.
Right.
So that is, if we don't hear what the patient said in a questionnaire that they complete, it gets lost in translation in that GP referral, because the GP may not have known all the questions to ask. They may not include all the relevant information in the referral note to the rheumatologist. So the rheumatologist doesn't know how soon do I need to see this patient compared to another patient with a robust referral letter that might be osteoarthritis and may not necessarily be needing to wait for a rheumatologist. So that is, really part of the challenge is that if you can have a good questionnaire, but if it's not accessible, if it's not integrated from a data standpoint, and it can't be combined with simple blood tests, even like a CRP, then you're kind of handicapped, if you will, from a clinical decision-making standpoint in making the best, in supporting the patient the best way possible.
Yeah. And I'm assuming the new diagnosis guidelines that just got approved by Spartan are sort of headed, I feel like they're headed in the direction you've headed.
Yeah. So, there are these classification criteria, I think everybody's very excited about, because they're going to increase the specificity of, making sure that if a patient has axSpA, that they're properly being diagnosed as axSpA and not being confused for mechanical back pain. So I think that that's a really big, and they're moving away from talking about radiographic versus non-radiographic, because at the end of the day, if you have axSpA, you have axSpA. It might be earlier in the continuum or later, but they all need, equal access to care and a proper diagnosis. I think what these tools will complement the ASAS classification criteria, because those are really used by rheumatologists to properly classify and diagnose patients, right? They use it as a classification tool to make their diagnosis. But upstream of that, there are still patients that are not So you need referral guidelines. And I think Spartan is also working on those actively separately from the ASAS classification criteria. So I think that's what I'm equally excited about that upstream, because that's where you're really going to start pushing the right patients into care. So those ASAS classification criteria can be used.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. So I want to turn toward biomarkers. I think all of us hear a lot about biomarkers.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, in plain terms, like, what are they and why do they matter in spondyloarthritis?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in the largest term of biomarkers, you know, a fingerprint is a biomarker, a pregnancy, you know, test, whether it's on urine or blood, is a biomarker. So it's really just things that are measuring, you know, what's going on in the body. And in our case at Augrex, we develop blood-based biomarkers. So it's essentially a blood test, and it measures a protein. It measures autoantibodies to that protein. And in autoimmune arthritis, those tell an important early story. They tell an important story along the disease course. And what I mean by that is, for example, in one of our blood tests, the first one, which is measuring a protein called 14-33-ADA, we tested it in very early disease in an indigenous population in Canada who were first degree relatives of people with RA. And these people did not have RA yet, but their blood was collected over time. And over a 10-year period, they started to look at what levels of different markers go up. And interestingly, 14-33-ADA, which is related to the blood test SpineStat for axial spondyloarthritis, 14-33-ADA and RA was coming up right at the transition of the inflammation of the lining that lines the joints. So that we know that these markers are early. So that helps with screening, for example. When you're trying to make a diagnosis, it helps if you combine it, for example, with CRP or HLA-B27. It gives you a more robust patient profile for a proper diagnosis. And then prognosis, it tells you sometimes how, based on how high the levels are, you know, how bad could this disease be? And if the levels don't drop, do you need to maybe be more aggressive with treatment? Or if they're dropping, maybe you can ease off of treatment and just kind of be more personalized in terms of the approach you take.
And the 14-33-ADA, if I got that right, is different from SpineStat, right?
It is, yeah. So just a little bit of biology here, and I think it's pretty straightforward. I think we all know that cells are spherical, and there's the inside of the cell and there's the outside of the cell, and 14-33-ADA is normally inside of the cell. It gets out in the context of damage and inflammation in autoimmune disease. It gets out of the cell where you can measure it in blood. But when it gets out of the cell, the body views it as foreign. So it mounts an antibody response, so like an immune response against the protein. And those autoantibodies are what we're measuring in axial spondyloarthritis in SpineStat.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that, so it's a blood test.
Yeah. It's a blood test, and those the autoantibodies are differentially expressed in people with axial spondyloarthritis compared to people with mechanical back pain. We just did this study that was presented at an oral presentation at the American College of Rheumatology, and it with a
we're there.
The team was there.
Say, I miss you.
Yeah, no, I know that would have been really cool. No, my team was there. I think they passed by your booth for sure. I don't know if you saw the team, Neil and Simran. And
I'm sure they did. I was in and out quickly. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to take us. Okay. I was not excited.
So it was presented there, and there was really a lot of excitement around it. Dr. Atul Deodar actually did a piece in Room Now specifically dedicated to this to talk about what the data showed. But really what was really exciting about it is that patients with axial spondyloarthritis had a very high SpineStat score compared to people with mechanical back pain who had a lower level, as low as healthy people who were considered healthy controls in the study. So
are those people who have a high SpineStat score, are they also people who may not be HLA-B27 positive?
Yeah, very good question. So we looked at whether patients were HLA-B27 or positive or negative, and actually the spine stat score did not differ between positives and negatives, which means it's telling a really different story than the HLA-B27 genetic status, if you will. And that kind of makes sense because this is what we call a soluble biomarker. It's a protein. Genes, as you know, don't really change your positive or negative. But biomarkers that are protein-based do because they're functional. And when their function is not needed anymore or when something else gets rid of them, they're not there anymore. So they're what we call modifiable. They change with the disease course. So you wouldn't expect it. Yeah, you wouldn't expect it to be telling the same story, which is why it's complementary. It's very exciting that it's complementary to HLA-B27 because there's a lot of people with HLA-B27 negative status who are sometimes assumed to not have AxSpA early in disease, right?
Yeah, that is so okay. You're like, I don't know how I haven't put two and two together on this. It's like, oh, if you're pregnant, you have a biomarker that says you have the pregnancy hormone. And if you're not, you don't. And if you spine stat may show disease activity, right? Like some sort of change. Manifestation versus none.
Yeah.
And our bodies change over time.
Exactly. It changes with therapy. It changes with all kinds of things that affect your condition, right?
And so is the baseline that like there's a, so spine stat is a score that can increase. So is someone who has AS, is high disease activity a high score correlation or?
Yeah, exactly. So that score is essentially a combination of, there's five different, you know, remember how I mentioned the 14338 a protein gets outside the cell? There are five highly immunogenic pieces of that protein that is what's causing the immune response. And we can measure the autoantibodies to those five. And it's the combination of those five that we put into the spine stat score, essentially. Yeah. So some patients might only are only positive for one or two, and some might be positive for all five and have high titers. Yeah.
What is a titer?
Titer is concentrations, like a lot of it present in the blood.
Okay. And a lot of us patients get the CRP or sometimes MRI is used to diagnose.
Yeah.
MRI is clearly imaging, but
yeah.
How is it different from the CRP?
Yeah. So CRP, C-reactive protein, is it's an inflammation marker. So it will tell you that there is inflammation in the body, but it won't tell you necessarily if it's because of the spondyloarthritis. So it's not specific. And in the study that we presented at the oral presentation, Dr. Raj Sengupta presented that. We saw that 14338 protein and the autoantibodies do not correlate with CRP. So again, telling a different story, and that CRP alone was not specific to AxSpA. So it was also high in people with back pain because they have sometimes with their mechanical back pain, they may also have inflammation. So the CRP is not correlating with 14338 autoantibodies, so they combine well. And similarly, like you mentioned with MRI, you know, it is imaging and it usually will show inflammation, which is kind of a result of these inflammatory processes. When you have a biomarker in the blood, it may show up actually before you even see the inflammation on an MRI. So it can be an early danger signal. That could also complement imaging. So the view is that SpineStat would never displace anything. It's going to augment and inform the patient profile in a way that nothing else does right now, because it's taking 7 to 10 years with our current methods to get a diagnosis. So anything that can kind of add to the picture in a specific way, because it's an immune marker, I think a lot of people are really welcoming that.
Yeah, it's not like something you could do like a pinprick when someone's born to track over time, could you?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, pinprick is possible. And we're looking at that as part of our development program, because hopefully people can pinprick themselves at home. You know, I was thinking about what would be the best place for this. Well, right now, realistically, in primary care or general practice, for example, with the GPs, but why not, if you're having joint pain and you're not sure you want to invest the time in the healthcare system or take time off work and so forth, wouldn't it be good if you could just do an at-home test that you could buy online? But at birth, well, you know, that's an interesting question, because I think this is something you would be wanting to use in people who are somewhat early symptoms. Yeah. But how interesting is that, you know, some people believe we were all born perfect and we actually develop these conditions over time because of all of the things that happen to us in our lives, right? Everything from, you know, what we eat to what we drink to thermal stressors to psychological and emotional stressors. And there's a, you know, I'm not the first to say this, of course, but there's a big school of thought that we actually develop disease, even though we might be predisposed genetically. We are developing diseases because of things that are happening to us often as we age, right?
Yeah, and that was my curiosity. It was like, well, could you see if people are predisposed and start or track it over time? Like, is there, because listen, if we can diagnose earlier, that's great.
Yeah.
Maybe we're just sort of spitballing in entrepreneur land over here right now.
Yeah.
But the idea of knowing, like, if I could have known my children were born and we had an idea of they were going to have sensitivity to inflammation, it would have been, right? We would have done things differently. When I was diagnosed, we started doing things differently for the kids. So maybe someday.
And then I think it becomes a health economic question too, right? Like, do you maybe want to just test specific groups that where they are at risk? Like, for example, first degree relatives, right?
Yeah.
Who are asymptomatic. You may want to do that just to kind of get ahead. But the really good news is for axial spondyloarthritis, it's not in all people, of course, but in a large number of people, if it is diagnosed early, like as soon as the patient has symptoms, just over 3 months, especially if they're under the age of 45, not necessarily, but if they are, you know, these people can respond extremely well to treatments that are out there. And I think we have to say that there are some very effective treatments out there, especially earlier in disease, but along the whole disease course, really, it's never too late. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Research. Tell us, what does it take to validate a new biomarker?
Yeah. So to me, there's three levels to that. That's a really interesting question. I think people want to know, right? You want to know is what your work, how do you arrive at this? One is biological mechanism, like actually looking at things in vitro, even, you know, in vivo in terms of taking blood out and seeing, you know, what's going on. So you want to know the biological mechanism of what's going, what is the story that this biomarker is telling in the body and what's the role that it's playing? So there's that piece of validation, is the biological piece. The second, and I think the biological piece goes, you just never stop doing it, because you can keep always learn more. And it's not that hard to do because you're doing it in the lab, in like what we call in vitro. But the other two pieces are sequential. One is the technical assay development. You have to develop a robust assay. You have to, an assay is the actual instrument or the thing that you tested on, right? It has to be reading properly and reproducibly. And then once you've got a robust assay, a robust test, you need to do good clinical studies. You need to get the right profile of patients to be able to discern the differences between different disease groups, like questions like you were asking, an HLA positive and negative, CRP positive or negative. How does it correspond with changes in MRI or with changes in radiographs over time? So you have to do all of these studies. And those are all parts of the FDA requirements to get a blood test actually approved for use with a specific indication.
And might I congratulate you that in the last 10 days, the FDA down here approved SpineStat. Is that right?
Well, yeah. So technically what they approved was that this is a, that it has a breakthrough device designation, which means that is pre-approved, that is pre-approval. So what that is to say, okay, you guys are intending to put in an application to FDA to approve this test. And based on what you've provided to us so far, we agree that there is a likelihood that this will succeed both technically and clinically, and that there is a high unmet need that this warrants breakthrough status. So what that does is it helps us get a lot of rigor and feedback from the FDA to help us make sure that we do all of the right studies. We also get, because they're kind of alongside us, the whole process, it should expedite access of an innovation like this to patients. So because FDA very much wants innovations to get to patients faster, they're a key part of that whole chain. So we don't have approval for the test yet by FDA, but we have this breakthrough status, which we hope will bring it to patients a lot faster.
That's fantastic. And is it today in use in Canada?
Yeah, so it was approved in Canada over the last year. I'm trying to remember our approval date. And it's also approved in the UK. And we're in the process of getting approval in Australia as well. So FDA, fingers crossed, within the next year, if we can get things done quickly with breakthrough.
And is the use primarily so far from approval is in primary care or rheumatology?
Well, usually these are in the specialists tend to use these first because they want to gain experience, understand when they're getting a patient with a positive test, a positive score, what it means, how it can inform things. And then it ends up being disseminated more broadly. But the rheumatologists really need to understand first what the result is. And although we work very closely with key opinion leaders worldwide, because it's a new test, it hasn't really reached all of the levels of clinical rheumatologists. And so that's usually the waterfall is, and then once, not every rheumatologist has to know about it before a GP uses it, but there at least has to be some level of familiarity and kind of a little bit of wider usage and understanding by rheumatologists before it is used by GPs. But that is definitely the goal.
Very cool. So do you see it, I guess, two-part question. One is on the side of use to guide personalized medicine.
Yeah.
Do you see it having an impact there? And then on the other side, do you think that it leads to more tailored treatment plans, which I guess goes along with personalized
medicine? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because if we can understand better what's going on in an individual's biology, and, you know, I might also say that in some people with AxSpA, it's negative, right? So they may have a combination of things that are driving their disease differently, but it's important to know that they're negative for this because they might be positive for HLA-B27 and perhaps have a moderate CRP. You see, so it really is about personalized medicine and profiling that individual's inflammatory condition. Right. And then, well, of course, when you know that, then you can start personalizing care, especially with the markers that are changing. Right. So HLA-B27 is not going to change, but and a lot of GPs don't even know to order it and in some places you can't, like insurance companies or like in Canada, a GP is not I believe in most provinces are not even able to order it because it's a very, you know, it's expensive.
Really?
Yeah. And so when you think of the whole personalized access to care, if you can get a spine stat and a CRP, which are both easy to get and easy to do and not that expensive at a GP level, then by the time the patient gets into their journey to rheumatology, the rheumatologist will then add HLA-B27, will then do an MRI and, you know, radiographs and all of the other clinical workup that they do, right? So when you think of the whole continuum that this patient, their journey through, the markers are telling a story along the way. And also like CRP and spine stat score change over time. They're dynamic. And so if you're giving somebody a treatment and they might be telling you their clinical response is okay, and you can tell that they're their response is okay, but their biology is saying, oh no, spine stat's still high, CRP is still high, then you can maybe dose intensify. Or on the opposite, if they're responding well and their markers are low, you can kind of just keep them at that level without, because no drugs are completely innocuous. You may want to just keep them, you know, at a certain level to reduce side effects, but maximize their actual efficacy, right? So it, really, that's what biomarkers allow you to do, especially if they change over time.
And
personalized care.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's moving fast, right?
Yeah, it is.
We're moving faster than I thought we would be. But not for everybody, right? Because there's still tons of lack of access to care and disparities. And do you think something like spine stat makes it easier to address and like overcome biases in care?
Absolutely. And I think you brought one up early on in our conversation today about male sex versus female sex, right? There are differences in the biology, and there are also very old guidelines or ways of approaching the condition that it still are paradigms that need to be dismantled, and biomarkers will help do that because, with sex, we don't see a difference in spine stat, but we do see a difference with age. And then when you put age and sex together, there's a moderation. And so when the spine stat score is actually even better when you add age and sex to it, in terms of now creating a new score, likelihood score with those three variables. So sex is definitely, and age, you know, those are real inequities do occur there. But also, like you also mentioned, HLA-B27, you know, Japanese people they only have a 1-2% positivity of HLA-B27, yet they have AxSpA. So this is, and same with Northern European people, they have the highest incidence of HLA-B27 positive and North American Indigenous people. So when you think of racial disparities, that's a big deal. And then just geographies, right? Race aside for a moment, when people live in remote areas, they have less access to care, and therefore generally not, they can't, if you don't access care as well, you don't get as good care. But if you can have like a finger prick test that can help inform your condition, then when either you go to where access is or traveling physicians go to you more promptly, especially if you had a questionnaire to answer too, right?
Right. Well, and it, the number of times I've met people along my journey, and you said it at the beginning, if they don't want to invest in their time in the medical system.
Yeah.
And we forget, right? I live in a pretty urban area, and I always say to people, isn't it, if they're complaining of, you know, symptoms or whatever, and I'm playing doctor, and I'm just like, but isn't it worth it to invest a copay and 2 hours of your life to find out? And this saves a ton of time. And I would imagine like in remote areas, it's so hard. And from a rheumatology perspective in a remote area,
it's
got difficult. So turning a little bit, what do you think in terms of personalized care as the norm? What do you think that is our biggest barrier in our health systems?
Yeah. So I know I already talked about data integration and, you know, this digital health. I think we're not integrated enough. That's the biggest problem in my mind, because when you combine these different pieces of information, you can just accelerate identifying people who have the condition so much more quickly. You know, questionnaire and a few simple blood tests. And really, that's very powerful. So I think data integration is, we really need to get that right soon, because the truth is, these tools are there. They're just not being used because they're not connected. This is a problem.
Maybe we should go out and fundraise for the personalized care version of Epic.
Right?
And just get it done. Like, let's go fix it.
And then I think the other really big problem, I think from a more of a system level too, is incentives around healthcare favor procedures more than they do prevention still, right? Like, even if you think of reimbursement and insurance, they're, okay. You know, like they, if you have a certain condition and you need a certain drug or a certain procedure, these things are all coded that way, but it's harder to code for prevention and expect healthcare company, you know, people to just pay for it because you just want to know, or you think.
Right.
So prevent, and if you're going to get high enough upstream to really prevent and do things early, there's a bit of a paradigm shift. And I think the good news, I'm actually feeling very optimistic about this, is that insurance companies are really on top of this now, is they realize healthy lives are less expensive to insure than unhealthy lives, right? So the more you can keep people healthy and prevent conditions, they're starting to build incentives around that. I don't know that we've got the traction we need, but I think that's really important. And I think these tools all need to be validated in real time. You know, we talk about learning health systems. It requires data integration, but very soon, if you have all of this in, you know, happening at the same time and you can access that data and filter through it, you can validate in real time exactly the combinations of things that are telling you different stories and different types of patients, you know. So with patients with different profiles, like an HLA-B27 positive, SpineStat positive, CRP negative patient with a positive MRI, how is that person different than someone who has all those opposites, but still has AxSpA, right? So you can, that is the holy grail. And so if we integrate, use the tools and make sure the right incentives exist to move care upstream, I think that would personalize things in a way that could transform life for everyone.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You've got my wheel spinning. so one thought, which I think you've probably thought a lot about, if you could redesign the whole diagnostic process for SPA.
Yeah.
Blank white sheet of paper, what would you do?
Yeah, so... I think I would, first of all, I think because questionnaires and biomarkers are the easiest thing to access, right? A questionnaire first, simply the easiest. I think it should start on at people's homes and on their phones. If I could start anybody who has back pain, who's had it for more than 3 months, who may or may not have had pain that started before the age of 45, I would want them to answer the CAFA-SPA questionnaire by Dr. Van Hoven, which is part of the patient said questionnaire. And because if they score over 1.5 points, they should be referred. And that would at least give them the incentive to go and talk to the incentive to actually engage with the healthcare system, number one. So self-screening, and then if I could have an at-home test of every one of our tests tomorrow, and so that's doing it from scratch, and is right. That we would have people do this, a finger prick. So now your questionnaire is saying you're above 1.5, your scores are saying you are, you want to get there quickly. And the rheumatologist wants to see you quickly. And then I would say that the last piece of that in the doing it from scratch would be, snapping my fingers and making this all digitally integrated, arguably before it's completely validated, because the validation can happen faster when you start asking the right questions analytically of a digitally integrated system.
You know, and build the data. Is it like build the data?
Exactly.
Yeah, you start to get more. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. And the reason that's important is because that is the big paradigm is always like you need to study thousands of patients in multi-center studies. And, you know, that takes millions, if not tens of millions of dollars and many, many years. We can't wait anymore. I saw this quote by Zig Ziglar that I loved. And it said that you don't have to be great to start, but you have to start to be great. You know, I think we just need to start using the data that's available.
I think people overlook that I'm going to say this to someone who's a PhD and probably a lot of clinical researchers who are listening.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is we have to get over perfection.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, right? This is, I think it screws up a lot of people's lives.
Yeah.
And we're so stubborn. And many of us, I'm sure many people listening, complained of many of these symptoms. There wasn't a test to look at it for a year or 5 years or 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. And I think we know more than we ever did, but yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's, I love your quote. That's, it's the best because it's like progress over perfection maybe in this case.
Right. Exactly. But you know, those clinicians listening, I think they would like what you're saying too, because what it also tells you is what's not effective in all that data, right? Because there's a lot of things that they're doing that they know, you know, may have changed over time, or it's been done by habit, or, but is it true? And that's the beauty, is that the data will tell you if it's true. You have to ask the questions of the data, but if it's not available and not integrated, you can't. So right. I think that's the exciting thing too. It's definitely to find people earlier with the conditions so you can intervene early. But it's also like, what are we doing that's not working? And let's let the data tell that story too.
Right. And I think there's also like, there's a lot of, you know, in the referral pathways, I heard somebody at ACR talking about this, a doc who said that whatever system they were involved with, like 90% of the rheumatologists would ignore the referral if it wasn't explicit that it was inflammatory back pain. Right. And right, there's this situation. And if a primary care had the tool to share with the room what they thought was really going on, or probably this exists in every specialty, I would guess.
Yeah.
But to speak to them, and I heard this once come up in a different context between a pediatric room and an adult room, who said, we don't always know how to talk to each other with the right language. And it was really interesting. Yeah. So maybe
that is interesting. That's why we need to listen to what the patient said, you know, and if we do these questionnaires, because it's the patient that completes it, or if they don't, if they need assistance in completing it, you know, that could accompany the referral letter. So at least the rheumatologist sees what the patient said. It's a bridge, right? It's a bridge. Yeah.
It is. We need more bridges. Okay. Last question. And this is where I want you to land the plane, because I'm feeling hopeful today. What gives you the most hope right now when it comes to innovation in spa?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if you're seeing what I'm seeing, but I feel like there's a lot of collaboration going on between patients and scientists, clinicians, you know, even at SAA, you guys are central to working with Spartan and other key groups who are not only including patients, but clinicians and guideline groups. Like, that is so important. And industry, like, I feel so privileged to be here, having been a founder of a biotech company, and you're inviting me to be here and to speak with you. To me, that's very exciting, because the opportunity to reduce what is currently a 7 to 10 year diagnostic delay, like there's only one way, and that's, you know, there's only one way, and it's up. It's like, it's upstream, it's earlier. And we have the tools. I believe the digital integration's happening. I believe insurance companies understand that tools that can be used earlier can help patients, and therefore even be health economically very sound. So I'm just very, I'm actually very excited about tech, biotech, and all of the interest group holders being working together to do this. And pharmaceutical companies, you know, these drugs are effective, and pharma has a really important role to play that I think they're taking very seriously from a collaboration standpoint. So it serves everybody for people to be diagnosed early.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I love the way you picked up on the collaboration. I often think that collaboration can be really tough. Like, you sit in a room full of various stakeholders and you say the word accelerate to one group, and they the group of clinicians has no idea what that means in that context. And, yeah. and being able to get to a point where we're all speaking the same language is really important. And
yeah,
it's so important that I believe systems change happens in that context of collaboration. And yeah. this is kind of what we're all after too. So yeah. amazing. Did I miss anything?
No, not at all. But I think implicit in all that, that we all feel almost every day is anybody who's using ChatGPT also gets a sense of how this digital integration, when you're thinking of it from a machine learning and, you know, natural language processing and AI, how much it really can accelerate innovation, you know? So I feel like that there is no better time for patients with axial spondyloarthritis and many other conditions, but I'm very, very hopeful.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We definitely want to keep in touch and keep updated on what you're working on next.
Thank you so much for having me, Jill. I appreciate it.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit, educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.